sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Last week, I shared the speeches by professor and author David McGregor and journalist and founder of the blog Who, What, Why, Russ Baker that were given at the Left Forum on May 31st, 2015 in New York City at John Jay College. On the panel called The American Deep State, How Capitalism Subverts Democracy. Today you'll hear the speech given by the third panelist, author, attorney, and journalist Andrew Craig. And I'll also read brief parts of Peter Dale Scott's new book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. So let's begin with a little bit of background on Andrew Craig. Andrew was a journalist for the Hartford Courant back in the 80s when he wrote the book about the media called Spiked. He became a lawyer and moved to Washington, D.C., where he currently resides and is the founder of the website Justice Integrity Project and is the author of the 2013 book Presidential Puppetry. If you're considering voting for Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton in the next presidential election, you might want to read this book before casting your vote. Many of you may already be familiar with Andrew Craig. He's been on my show and on Mike DeRosa's show New Focus in the past. And he spoke at the University of Hartford in April of this year. So here he is, Andrew Craig, at the Left Forum.
What my focus is current affairs, a little bit like Russ, but also what we can do about it. So I'm going to start with that kind of solution, which is actually somewhat obvious, because this is where it starts. People talking, learning new facts, it might be entertaining, but more important, productive. And having questions answered so that we can kind of fan out. And I'll just say that my own education on many of these topics is built on going to many seminars, conferences, listening to other people, reading books, but also I've got to take my hat off to Cheryl, a radio host, David, and some others who have kind of taken me gently from my focus on Washington affairs, national affairs, in areas that I thought I knew about and could make a contribution, and reminding me that there are areas like 9/11 where we all have to be citizens. We all have to educate ourselves, and we shouldn't be in what Russ called the silos. At a conference Cheryl organized just a couple months ago at the University of Hartford, I said, well, it's kind of my coming out party on 9/11 because while I have 15 books on them, I haven't read them all. But then I thought, well, what's the magic number? 16? 17? Or do you have to read 12 of the 17? No, we all have to care about these very, very big issues that, as Russ mentioned, the media really can't get into. It's not just the economics and the advertising, it's the control factor. So I'm going to get into a little bit part of my story, but also right into current affairs and how the control factors actually work in the media and in law and business. And let's start by saying, for brevity, we say the CIA did this, Operation Mockingbird, the propaganda operation, or other things. My investigation step by step into Washington politics and some of this history indicate that the CIA, when you think about it, when you research it, is really the handmaiden for what might be called the deep state. Some might call it Wall Street, some might call it the military-industrial complex, or some combination of it. But if you look at, for example, the Dulles brothers, Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles. John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State. Alan Dulles ran the CIA And you'd think, well, okay, they're kind of government officials. Actually, their real function was as Wall Street lawyers for the most prestigious and powerful law firm, probably in the country, Sullivan and Cromwell here in New York, whose clients were at the more or less Rockefeller, Harriman level, and their companies, and the J.P. Morgan bank level. And it's still the case that much of Washington is populated by lawyers who are might hold a government position, but they're really the operational arm for these people in the deep state who want to stay in the background. Well, going to current affairs, oh, by the way, I'll just add that many of them are actually part of the media because they own it. So, for example, I've recently been looking at how many people came out of the Office of Strategic Services in World War II who went on to big jobs in the media. And it's many, many people at many of these organizations, and many ended up at the CEO or publisher level. Here's a few examples. William Paley, Scotty Ressin, a longtime Washington bureau chief of the New York Times. But the most interesting one to me these days is, I guess I'd say, Bill Casey, Sumner Redstone, and a lesser-known person named C.D. Jackson, Charles Douglas Jackson, who alternated between Time Life, beginning in 1931, and government. And he came out of OSS, and he was the worldwide acknowledged secret master of information warfare for the United States. And then he becomes National Security Advisor in the Eisenhower White House, and then he becomes publisher of Time Life magazine in the early 60s. And he acquires the Zapruder film and suppresses it. He acquires the rights to the memoirs of Marina Oswald and never publishes it. So here he's running the two most powerful influential magazines in the country, and he comes out of psychological warfare background at the high level. Well, let's fast forward. So last week, Michael Morell was on the circuit talking about Al-Qaeda. Now, he retired from CIA in 2013 as deputy director. He had twice been acting director of the CIA. He's had 33 years in the agency. You've probably seen him on TV if you watch much. He's got a new book about how Al-Qaeda is a great threat to America. And he was at the National Press Club, where I'm a member, and I often go to see things. And he was giving a press conference. I was a little surprised to see there were only about 12 or 14 people there. But that was great for me, because I had a chance to ask him questions. And I asked him, as I recall, three questions. He said he didn't know the answer to any of them. This is on C-SPAN, and here are the three questions. I said, there's a certain amount of controversy on the internet and elsewhere. Who did Senator McCain meet in his 2013 trip to Syria when he was meeting the rebels? And some say it was with the future leaders of ISIS. He's denied that. Who was he meeting? And Michael Morell, who's now a CBS senior analyst for intelligence, among other things, of course, the revolving door and consulting work. So he's quite knowledgeable person, you would think. He said he didn't know. And moving on quickly, I said, well, my understanding is that the CIA is the major obstacle to release of the remaining JFK documents that were supposed to be released under the JFK Act, and also to the release of the 28 pages of who funded the 9/11 hijackers. And to both of those questions, he said he didn't know anything really much about it. So what this indicates to me, having spent much of my career in mainstream publications and business organizations, is that even if you go through the steps and you're somehow able to talk to the people who theoretically should know, they'll say, I don't know. And so that's a great way to kill a story through just, you can't quite get both sides of things. Now that's happening quite a bit, not just on big stories, but in smaller ones throughout Washington. And something that's happened, not just there, but across the country, I hear from my colleagues, is that we have the public information officer is inserted between reporters and newsmakers. And I didn't see this in my early part of my career when I'd cover courts and I'd talk to judges, I'd talk to prosecutors, I'd talk to defendants, I'd talk to everybody up and down the line and put the questions to them, sometimes off the record. But there's a barrier now. And it's a huge threat to democracy because it's not simply a physical barrier, but the people you want to talk to can get fired if they talk to you. And because of the surveillance state, who's ever in control of them is going to know. I mean, for one thing, they have blanket statements. You're supposed to come forward if you've talked to a reporter in many areas that are sensitive or not even that sensitive. And it's a control mechanism. And as James Risen of the New York Times has recently pointed out, I don't see how you can have a democracy if reporters can't talk to newsmakers except in certain narrowly circumscribed areas, and talk to people who, you know, whether whistleblowers or just people who know something that help us put together the story. One of the things we can do is help each other out, overcome these silos. And so one of the most effective things I've seen, positive, is the Moral Mondays movement. How many people know what that is? I spent a lot of time a year ago in Selma with Reverend Barber, actually about 5 days, at the big Selma march a year and about 14 months ago. And I heard his description of it, and the brief description is that if each person advocates on their issue, silo fashion, people aren't going to get anywhere. But what they've done quite successfully up to a point in North Carolina is have, let's say, the people who want better pay for teachers, don't have the teachers advocate that. Have the seniors advocate that. And have the teachers advocate for the prison guards. And have the prisoners' rights people advocate for the seniors. And so you have a web of coalitions. It helps in that case that many of the people are willing to go to jail, at least briefly, for nonviolent protests. And they were laughed at the beginning. They made quite a bit of progress in North Carolina. I'm going to talk a little bit about Alabama in a couple contexts here, but they started the same thing in Alabama, but people went right back to their own silo mentality, and they didn't get anywhere in Alabama because it was all their organization and being very isolated. Here's the other thing I'm going to mention about Alabama. It kind of led to my, along with some other things, but a major import was we were looking at people unfairly prosecuted or people who were not prosecuted at all. And one of the major cases in the country, human rights violations, is Don Siegelman in Alabama. How many people are at least briefly aware of him? Well, he's served as governor from 1999 to 2003. He was very popular in a red state. He was a Democrat. In fact, he was potential presidential material because he had built these coalitions. He was quite popular. And he was immediately investigated by the state attorney general beginning in 1999. And he was relentlessly prosecuted, imprisoned. He's still in prison for actions that happened in 1999 that most people, reasonable people, would think are not even a crime. But it totally destroyed the Democratic Party, which is almost bankrupt, but also it's a moral calamity for this country of why and how he was prosecuted. So that led me into what I call deep researches. I didn't call it at the time, but now I know it's deep researches of how this corruption charge could stick for so long, cost tens of millions of dollars of taxpayer money to keep this man in prison and prosecute him. Basically, his main crime was he asked one of the richest people in the state to donate money to a nonprofit group called Alabama Education Foundation to improve funding for public schools through a lottery. And this helped activate a bizarre combination of casino interests, Karl Rove, who is an advisor to the Alabama Republican Party, Christians opposed to gambling, and people who just didn't like Siegelman and Democrats. And a special prosecution unit was established at Maxwell, the Air Force base down there. And they put an Air Force colonel in charge of it. And the case was ultimately routed to a chief federal judge, Mark Fuller, who secretly controlled up to 44% of a military contracting company, DAS Aviation. None of the defense attorneys, the public, knew about this. Now, what does DAS Aviation do? They train U.S. and international pilots for air forces. I kind of thought before getting into this, don't we have an Air Force Academy? They train Saudi pilots. One of the pilots, Muhammad Atta, whistleblowers came out of the woodwork on this case. There was no thorough investigation of their charges, even though they wanted to testify under oath, and they would get really nowhere, even after 60 Minutes belatedly did a report in 2008. And nothing happened. Why does the Obama administration not step into this? And ultimately, that led me into many of these other areas, including 9/11, but also the theme of my book, Presidential Puppetry, which is looking at control mechanisms and grooming of elected candidates, penetration of not just businesses and the media, but even churches and the military, by those who have a certain loyalty to the CIA, but it's really ultimately to this deep state apparatus, even when their official job title is in business, religion, government. And as a finding that I believe is documented and really not challenged reasonably so far, is that every recent president after Jimmy Carter has had a hidden relationship with the CIA or FBI before they entered politics. What was President Obama's first job out of Columbia? It was Business International Corporation in the research imports and exports. Now, what other people are involved in imports and exports aside from the people who really are? Well, one is James Bond. You know, he worked for Universal Export because he didn't go around saying he was a spy because it allowed him to travel all over the place. It sounds kind of boring, so nobody says, really, what else you're doing? Well, here's two other examples, but there's many other examples. One is Valerie Flame Wilson. Her company, Brewster Jennings, when she was outed by the Bush administration, it was imports and exports. Also, Clay Shaw, who was head of the International Business Mart in New Orleans. District Attorney Jim Garrison indicted for conspiracy to murder President Kennedy. That prosecution is where the term conspiracy theorist was actually popularized, because beginning around 64, 65, but especially in 1967, the CIA started a campaign through their agents of influence. I think we heard a little bit about it, but I'm going to flesh it out, to call critics of the Warren Commission conspiracy theorists and making sure that they were tarred with this in their professional careers so that nobody wants to go near that. And fortunately, through the declassified process, we know about some just amazing things that our government has done, including a 50-page memo from April 1967 outlining this conspiracy theorist smear. And I would just ask one thing we should all do. If any time that term is used, we should just ask who's ever using it to consider what the implications are if we call it an evidence theorist. Because, by the way, there is bad evidence, some supplied by disinformation agents. And we should never use that term about each other or what we're doing, because it's become a code word for making critics of government look like they don't deserve their jobs, and that's not going to help us. There are some very significant other major documents that are available. It keeps happening, and it's not reported what comes out, but every single person here should know about Operation Northwoods, which was a plan rejected by Kennedy and even his defense secretary, Robert McNamara, but it was by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to say, suppose the U.S. government created hijackings and riots and killed people and then blamed it on Castro, then we could have a war against Cuba, a real war. And that's an actual document. Everybody should know about that. And when people think about something like 9/11, Iran-Contra, and many of these other things, it's right there. A new document that some of us who investigate JFK have recently come across, and most people have not seen it. It's available in the Mary Farrell collection. But this is October of 1964. It's a memo distributed at the high levels of the FBI. And it says that the Bureau has done a quick look at the Warren Commission staffers who had become public, and it found what it calls derogatory information concerning the following individuals or their relatives. And this is widely circulated at the top echelons of the FBI. And among the people are some quite well-known staffers on that commission, but also an interesting name who most of us didn't realize was working on it, Stephen G. Breyer, the future Supreme Court Justice. And this leads to a whole other area that's worth at least touching on, which is the use of blackmail, systematic use of blackmail against public officials. And we see that it goes way back. My investigations into the Siegelman case and many others, including from whistleblowers who worked to create this kind of political opposition research against different elected officials, indicates it's still quite widespread. So no matter what your issues are, there are in place blackmail operations. Gerald Ford was being blackmailed. That was why he was put on the commission and named as vice president. He was feeding Hoover the confidential reports, and that Gerald Ford, the future president, himself changed some of the diagrams of Oswald that later became public. A number of current figures who they've researched blackmail files on, and it's used for pressure on political issues. So no matter what your issues are, Woodrow Wilson is obliquely complaining in a quote about, in effect, the deep state. And what he doesn't say is that he was being blackmailed himself by the Wall Street figures who helped fund Teddy Roosevelt to split the Republican vote and have their puppet, Woodrow Wilson. So we have a long history of this that's not at all apparent. That led to his change from being a high school wrestling coach to a political career. And that story was written. It never got anywhere. But suddenly he's indicted for $3.5 million in blackmail. But the question is, how does he get so much money to pay $3.5 million when most of his career is in government? But two, and it's only coming out now, hints of this, but we've got to know the general theory of it as we make our own decisions. We should always have out there, I haven't written hardly any of this sex stuff, but we've got to know the general theory of it as we make our own decisions. Now, the best part of an event like this is hearing the questions and being hopefully able to answer them or at least think about your insights so we can all make progress in some productive ways. So thank you very much.
In the Q&A that followed the panelists' presentations, Andrew Craig was asked how far back the deep state goes. This was his response.
Well, I would recommend a starting point of reading about the Opium Wars in the 1840s and so forth, where the British, with some complicity of other Western powers, including the United States, wanted to open China to trade. And sometimes it's thought, well, silk and spice and tea. And you think, well, what's a lot of tea? I mean, what are these spices? But it really is narcotics. And some of the great American fortunes were made at that time. And that's approximately the time that the Yale Skull and Bones was created in 1838. And I went to Yale Law School and, you know, I'd heard about this undergraduate group. I really didn't pay it hardly any attention until recently when in 2004, both George Bush and John Kerry had been members of this Skull and Bones. Only 15 people a year are picked in the entire United States, and two of them are running against one another. And Kerry could well have been cheated out of the election, but he certainly didn't fight very hard. But I think some of this stuff does go back, but probably not literally to the beginning of the country.
Next, Andrew was asked a question about Cecil Rhodes and Carol Quigley in the 1870s and the shadow government in the UK and how that shadow government was then transferred to the US. And this is his response.
Yes, that's a very good point. And approximately that time, or maybe about 110 years ago, is the best time I would put for this in the United States. And what they did was, as Carol Quigley, a longtime iconic professor at Georgetown, who was mentor to Bill Clinton, among others, he wrote excellent books about this. And he pointed out that an inner circle funded by Rhodes, with his diamond fortune and so forth, would install people in government, the news media, academia, and so forth, and they all would have basically the same ideas that they'd work out, and it would look like an independent experts have all decided the same things.
And again, that was author and journalist Andrew Craig speaking at the Left Forum. To learn more about Andrew or to read his blog, the website is www.justice-integrityproject.com. And now here's the piece from Peter Dale Scott's book, The American Deep State. And here goes. The deep state was defined by the UK newsletter on religion as the embedded anti-democratic power structures within a government, something very few democracies can claim to be free from. The term originated in Turkey in 1996 to refer to United States-backed elements, primarily in the intelligence services and military, who had repeatedly used violence to interfere with and realign Turkey's democratic political process. Sometimes the definition is restricted to elements within the government or a state within the state. But more often in Turkey, the term is expanded for historical reasons to include members of the Turkish underworld. In this chapter, I shall use deep state in the larger sense to include both the second level of secret government inside Washington and those outsiders powerful enough in either the underworld or overworld to give it direction. In short, I shall equate the term deep state with what in 1993 I termed a deep political system, one which habitually resorts to decision-making and enforcement procedures outside as well as inside those publicly sanctioned by law and society. Like myself, Mike Lofgren suggests an ambiguous symbiosis between two aspects of the American deep state. One, the beltway agencies of the shadow government, like the CIA and NSA, which have been instituted by the public state and now overshadow it. And two, the much older power of Wall Street, referring to the powerful banks and law firms located there. Top-level Treasury officials, CIA officers, and Wall Street bankers and lawyers think much alike because of the revolving door by which they pass easily from private to public service and back. In Lofgren's words, quote, "It is not too much to say that Wall Street may be the ultimate owner of the deep state and its strategies, if for no other reason than that it has the money to reward government operatives with a second career that is lucrative beyond the dreams of avarice, certainly beyond the dreams of a salaried government employee." Unquote. If you've been paying attention at all, you probably realize that the assassinations of the 1960s, JFK, RFK, MLK, the Oklahoma City bombings, 9/11, and the Boston Marathon bombing, to name just a few, are all deep events orchestrated by the deep state. They're also known as SCADs, or State Crimes Against Democracy. But don't take my word for it. I encourage you to do your own research and arrive at your own conclusions. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.